listening to Harrismith Radio. Hey there, I'm your host, Wayne McPhail. This episode begins with a chat with a guerrilla gardener, gardening planner, and writer, Lorraine Johnson, about the bounty that can be had from gardens in every nook, cranny, and backyard in our cities. Next up, a seasonal exercise in making good use of holiday leftovers. And we learn the secrets of great duck for Christmas so you can roast like a Victorian. By the way, if you want to read Harrismith Magazine instead of listen to it, you can subscribe to the print version online at harrismithmag.com. And you can find Harrismith Magazine on selected newsstands across Canada. But for now, settle in for the next half hour of Harrismith Radio. When it was still warm and sunny, I got to sit outside at the Royal Botanical Gardens here in Hamilton and chat with Lorraine about the capacity that cities and the folks who live in those cities have to produce healthy, local, affordable, and nutritious food. We discuss sharing, brownfields, and the tales in the soil beneath our feet, including the wonderful story of the Montreal melon. Here's that summary conversation.
Well, I think all food contains within it stories about our culture, our history, our society. It's full of, you know, full of story. But the Montreal melon is a particularly wonderful story in that the Montreal melon used to be, like at the turn of the century, a popular melon. It was expensive. It was rare. It was sent overseas. It was eaten by kings and queens. Like it was a famous melon grown in Montreal. And what a strange idea. And then with, you know, mechanization of agriculture, it went out of favor and it was pretty much forgotten. And through the efforts of one fellow who has a nursery, and he was doing some research, and he found seeds of this melon in a seed library somewhere, and he started cultivating it. And there's been a revival, and that's just one amazing story, I think, of the way that our foods, the foods we grow, our agriculture, there's stories in everything. And there's a danger in kind of when something goes out of production, when people stop growing it, we lose a part of ourselves and our history.
Let's talk about cities and gardens, because I think that people sort of divorce cities and gardens, right? And sort of have, you know, sort of separate solitudes.
Yes.
But in your book, you argue that cities are actually a really good place to grow food.
Yes, I think there are a lot of environmental problems that can be traced to a false dichotomy that is so strong in our culture, and it has to do with city and country. And we separate those and say there are things that happen in the city that stay in the city, and there are things that happen in the country that stay in the country. And we don't think about how, you know, cities can be places of food production, and if they were, that would connect us with a basic essential need, like to eat, to grow food. It would connect us to our home place. So many things that could happen, good things that can happen when we grow our own food and in the city. It can teach kids, for example, hey, carrots don't come out of a plastic bag. There's real effort and labor and input that go into that. There's someone's hard work. That's good for kids to know. Like if we foreground the processes that keep us alive, if we foreground those in the places where, you know, the vast majority of us live, I think it makes it harder for us to think that there's this place called away where we can throw our garbage and, you know, produce our toxins and, you know, use chemicals and think that they don't actually have an impact on us.
One of the things you point out is that actually growing food in a city is quite efficient, which I think certainly surprised me.
Right? Yeah. Well, because they're so, well, because we think of cities as places with very little growing room, it forces a kind of economy of scale or efficiency of scale. So people are developing really wonderful ways of growing a lot of food in
like
small
square foot gardening.
Yeah, square foot gardening, growing a lot of food in a small space. And that's wonderful. But I also think there is a lot more room, land, in the city than we think. Like, if you go and look around at, you know, vacant lots, undeveloped land, park spaces that aren't necessarily used for sports or other sorts of things. I'm not saying we have to fill everything by any means. I think there have to be like vacant places where, you know, nature just kicks along on its own speed, doing where there's not human management. But I think there's a lot more room in the city where food could be grown, productive, potentially productive spaces. And we just need to look for them and have the will to go through all of the effort to get permission. Or actually, there's something called guerrilla gardening, of course, where you do it without permission, and that's pretty amazing.
Cool. So let's go back to the vacant land idea, because I think a lot of people imagine the country as being a land of manure and fresh soil and stuff, and the city, especially brownfield areas, may contain heavy metals or other toxins. So why would I want to grow in that kind of ground? So how do you balance that?
Yeah, what I find very interesting, you know, I give talks a lot about growing food in the city, and, you know, inevitably people respond with, wait, isn't city soil really toxic? Shouldn't I be worried? Like, is it clean enough to grow food? And I always find that a little ironic, because, you know, we'll go to the grocery store and buy food that's grown in a country where we have no idea what the health and safety rules are, what the labor practices are, what kind of pesticide laws there are in those countries. So we're out of sight, out of mind, we don't worry about it. And yet, in cities where we actually have some control, and actually a lot of cities have cosmetic pesticide bylaws now, so actually if you're growing food in the city, by default you're growing it organically. Plus, in the city, in your backyard, for example, it's very easy to research the history of your particular plot, wherever it is that you're growing food, whether it's in a community garden in a park or in your backyard or in a container on your balcony. I mean, you can find out so much about the health of that soil. You can do soil tests, you can look at some records, you can phone up City Hall and say, hey, how do I find out about the history of this little piece of land? Was there ever any industry on it? You can find that out. You can have control in a way that you can't when you're getting your food. You're putting in your body something that's grown under conditions that you have no idea about.
And one of the advantages, too, of growing in the city is you're dealing with biodiversity as opposed to the monoculture of some farms, right?
Yeah, amazingly, it's always surprising to realize that actually cities can be better pollinator habitat, for example. In rural areas, sometimes in agricultural areas, there might just be like one crop grown. And that's actually, it's not very diverse for pollinators, for the insects that need nectar at different seasons, different months, different times of the year. So cities actually often have that diversity in a way that rural areas don't necessarily.
Let's talk about cities, local versus the country. One of the things that you point out is that it's really hard when you actually look at it and look at carbon footprints and look at the cost of growing locally versus getting stuff from other places and shipping it in. It's actually a really difficult equation to figure out what actually makes sense, right? So how do you work that out so that you know, you don't sort of disappear up your own butt trying to deal with it?
Especially in the last 20 years, when there's been so much interest and research done into a kind of ecological accounting and life cycle analysis of every single thing. Well, you could get bogged down trying to feel like you immobilized, trying to figure out for absolutely everything in your life, everything you eat, everything you buy, everything you're involved in, how it compares to every other possible thing you could be doing or eating or buying, how it compares in terms of the ecological cost. So I think it actually makes a lot of sense to, I think, rely on a couple of basic principles. One of which, you know, I believe very strongly that if we can grow food without synthetic chemicals, that's a really good way to grow food. Use nature as a model. That's a guiding principle that I think is a pretty good one. I'm trying to think of examples where that's caused problems. Like, if you look at natural processes and use those as your guide, I think that's a pretty good principle. Another one is biodiversity leads to health and resilience. I think that's another kind of basic guiding principle that can really help you when you're trying to make decisions about all kinds of things.
And it's got to taste good.
But the great thing is that the organic, the local, the fresher, all that stuff, it does taste better. So, I mean, the industrial, agricultural, complex, global food system is not actually, it does not have taste as its priority. When you're spending the time and effort, or a farmer is spending the time and effort and going to a farmer's market, growing that food, taste is pretty important to people who are growing their own food. It's a different thing in the big ag complex.
So let's talk a little bit more about another aspect of carbon footprint and buying local, which is in cities there's poverty, there's neighborhoods that don't have access to good food, there's people who can't shop at farmers markets because it's too expensive, can't strike up a relationship with somebody that grows meat outside the city, and it makes it very difficult for them to grow their own food because they're in apartment buildings that are, you know, cheek by jowl with another one. So how do you reconcile the cost of buying local, buying organic, and the difficulty of growing local for somebody who is strapped in terms of money?
Yeah, strapped in terms of money and time, because if you're working three jobs to support yourself and your family, you're not going to have a lot of spare time to grow your own food. So I think there are lots of things that have to happen to fix our broken food system, a lot of things, and there are a lot of great people working on those issues. I would say that the way that urban agriculture fits into that as one piece of the solution is to have food production as just a normal part of what we do in the city, so that someone who is struggling to afford fresh food has the option of taking part in a community garden project or a community bulk buying of fresh produce.
And a lot of the food that's grown in community gardens goes to food banks.
So community gardens are great ways to help people have access to fresh, nutritious food. There are also great projects like the Plant a Row, Grow a Row, which is a joint project. The Composting Council of Canada is involved with it, where community gardens will grow an extra row of vegetables and donate it to food banks. There's so many wonderful models of communal ways we could be making fresh, fresh, nutritious food available and accessible to the people who need it. And I think that should be our priority. That should be one of our main social goals, to make sure that everyone has access to fresh, healthy, nutritious, culturally desired food.
Lorraine, you've been doing this for a long time. You've been growing your own food in your backyard. You've been guerrilla gardening. You've done just about any kind of gardening locally in cities that you can. What difference has it made in your life?
I think that for me, the gardening does what meeting, it's a very social thing for me. What I love about gardening and what it has done for me is the way it's a connection with people. It's a connection with your neighbor, like where you talk and share seeds and find out what they're growing and you share stuff. It's a connection with your community. I'm involved with community projects, so of growing food or, you know, trying to green the city or whatever. And it's just food, I think, is a really great way to bring people together. It's something we all need. It's something we all, need, and many of us love everything about it, you know, preparing it, sharing it, eating it, growing it. It's something that can really bring people together. And so for me, that's what all my various gardening projects over the years, my gardens, whatever, everything has been about connecting with people.
That was Lorraine Johnson, a little hint of green in this white season. "'Twas the morning after Christmas, and all through the house not a creature was hungry, not even your spouse." Yeah, like that's ever happened. Somehow, everyone seems to get an extra stomach for the holidays, but that's okay, because as Harrismith food writer Signe Langford explained to me, Christmas dinner leftovers are perfect for inventive breakfast treats. Here's our tasty tongue wag. Hey, Signe, thanks for joining us. This time out, we're going to be talking about Christmas dinner and then the aftermath of Christmas dinner. That being
the, you mean the leftovers.
The leftovers, the breakfast after the dinner. So you've got everybody who's had a lot to eat, probably a lot to drink the night before. They're waking up at various times. So you're hoping that you can recycle some of the stuff from the night before. Let's talk about how you do that.
I've found that very often, if you've done a big spread, you can't even find room for it in the fridge. I have been known to use my car as an outdoor larder.
Wow.
I have too much stuff. But, you know, there is a surprising amount of lovely, delicious things you can make with the leftover Christmas spread. Now, and a lot of people do have another round of eating. The next morning, they might be having a late Christmas morning brunch or even a Boxing Day brunch, that kind of thing. Yes, there's things you can make for breakfast with your leftovers, but also, I mean, I want to just talk about all the wonderful things you can make with everything for lunch and then dinners for the next several days. I have to tell you, I have seen, and it is heartbreaking, I've seen people throw out the turkey carcass the next day.
So no
and
soup for them.
Yeah, I was like, I'm going to have to unfriend you. I'm not even sure we can be friends anymore, because that to me is such an affront to the turkey and such a horrible contributor to food waste, and it shocked me. But, and I'm not naming any names. It's like criminal. But there's so much. A turkey carcass is a beautiful thing. Yeah. Like you're saying, soup, but even just that next day, get in there and strip off like all the big obvious meat bits. And don't forget underneath, pick that bird up and check underneath. And there's,
yeah, there's
meat
dark
the
meat medallions under there, right?
Oh, the little oysters.
Yeah.
Yeah, lovely. And of course, if you get enough of a pile of meat on the side from picking at the carcass, you can make a beautiful breakfast hash. Let's say you've got, you know, a typical spread. Let's say you got some potatoes left over, they're cold. Maybe you've got some leftover squash or turnip or sweet potatoes, and you've got this turkey. What else might you have on your table? There's some gravy maybe left over. But you know what? In the morning, you can take all that stuff, put it in a frying pan, nice big cast iron pan, little olive oil or a little turkey fat. Start tossing that up, get it nice and brown. You can add some fresh herbs if you like to freshen it up. And then crack some eggs on top and bung it in the oven. And in about 10 minutes, you have beautiful egg top hash. Bring it to the table in the cast iron pan or the casserole, and just with a little bit of toast, and you've got a lovely breakfast.
Yeah. But and cranberry juice.
Yeah, with cranberry juice on the side, of course, you've got the cranberry sauce. So what I like to do also with leftover, now you've got the leftover cranberry sauce and you've got leftover turkey. One of my favorite sandwiches in the whole wide world is poultry and jam. So that can be leftover roasted chicken and apple jelly, but it could also be turkey and cranberry sauce. And you put that between two slices of buttered toast, it is so good. And then you can dress that up as much as you want, but just that, oh, it's a little taste of the night before, you know? It's really nice. Leftover stuffing. Now, depending on what kind of stuffing you make, I don't know, there's the two schools of thought, right? There's the in-the-bird stuffing and there's the on-the-side stuffing. I think people are moving towards on-the-side stuffing because they're a little concerned about not getting it up to temperature or something. I'm not sure. But the next day, if you've done an on-the-side stuffing, sometimes that can be sliced. It sort of sets into a compacted loaf. If you can slice that, you can fry that. And then you have a really fantastic little fried bread thing that you can have with eggs and sausage and bacon for a breakfast the next morning. It's quite neat. Or you can chop it up and that stuffing can go into that hash I talked about earlier.
Right.
So if you don't have potatoes, put in the stuffing. It's delicious. Frying bread, of course, you better not be counting your butter calories because it's very absorbent. Right. There's lots you can do. And another thing I like to do is if I've got a nice pile of meat from that carcass, maybe the next night I'll have a pasta dish to get away from the whole Christmas theme and just do a pasta and make it simple and toss that stripped bits of meat with hot noodles and a bit of olive oil. Simple, delicious. Maybe throw in some baby arugula and just, it's light, it's fresh, It's got greens. It's a really great way. Now, and I always find by Boxing Day, I could murder for a curry. I just need spice. I've had sweet, I've had meat, I've had fat, I've had buttery things, bready things, and now all I want is a curry. So whether it's maybe a Vietnamese pho, just a simple spicy broth with a little bit of the meat shredded in, or a turkey curry with a green Thai curry base, or a madras. That really, I'm going to politely say, sets your system right again.
That's great. So you're making it seem like it's not even worthwhile making the turkey dinner for the dinner. Like you just save all that stuff and make breakfast for the rest of the season. So thanks very much for sharing those tips with us. And I'm coming to your place the day after Christmas for sure.
Okay.
Thanks very much.
My pleasure.
That was Signe Langford, defriending folks for the strangest of reasons. And now as a bit of a Victorian holiday lanyap, we present Chris Konzelman of King Cole Ducks about how to create a wonderful duck dinner for the holidays. Hey, Chris, thanks very much for joining us. Your family has been involved in raising ducks and selling ducks and cooking ducks for four generations now. I think your great-grandfather and grandfather started the company, right?
That's right, 68 years ago.
Your background is culinary coming into the company. So I wanted to talk about cooking duck for Christmas. And when I was looking at recipes, one of the things that really struck me was something that resonates with me, because when I talk to my wife about cooking a goose or a duck for Christmas, she's really worried about it being a very fatty, greasy bird. And, you know, I was looking at some older recipes and they talk about actually taking a duck, piercing its skin like you're stabbing it to death, and then putting it in a stock pot and boiling it for 45 minutes to get the fat out of it. Is that something that you would recommend?
So that's a great question. Duck itself is certainly a misunderstood protein. Typically, what people are worried about, just like your wife, is the fat content. It is a little different than other proteins, where duck's actually an extremely lean protein. The only fat content on a duck is the quarter-inch fat cap that's around the entire outside, just underneath the skin. So when cooking it, duck, you do want to think about rendering out that fat, spending a little bit more time to create that crispy skin. So you're absolutely right with the old school method of boiling, because it certainly does take out some fat cap. The problem with that is that you're also boiling the meat underneath. So you lose that tenderness, right? To be honest with you, my number one recommendation for a whole roast duck is low and slow. Absolutely can prick the skin. All that's going to do is just open up the skin to allow that fat to render out slowly, give it basically an escape, right? Personally, our favorite here is a roasted duck, but it's really important to keep that duck, I'm going to say, raised up on a rack or something like that. So all that fat that's rendering out, the duck isn't actually sitting in and acting like a sponge to soak it back in. The other thing I do want to touch on, and when we're talking about duck fat, is I understand that everybody is so health conscious nowadays that fat gets a bad rep. But duck fat is actually 13% polyunsaturated fat. So what that means is it's a lot closer to an olive oil than it is a butter or a lard.
So when you're talking about it coming off the bird, you would also not suggest putting like potatoes right underneath it or anything, because they're going to suck it back up again, right?
So once again, I mean, duck fat, it's the good fat. I always like to call it liquid gold. Certainly never throw that fat that comes out into the pan away. You can use it for absolutely duck fat potatoes. That's the number one. Any starch. I use duck fat just like olive oil whenever I'm seasoning. If you're doing garlic breads or like you said, potatoes is really our number one. It adds a velvety richness to those starches, right?
Now, we talked about doing the duck whole, and I know I remember seeing a Julia Child recipe where she suggests actually cutting the duck up and doing the wings and legs separately, right? Is that something that might be a good approach as well?
So absolutely. I mean, a duck breast is, in my opinion, one of the most underrated cuts. Everybody loves the duck leg confit because, you know, French traditional cuisine has made it so popular. And let's not pretend it's not fantastic either. But the duck breast, if it's cooked properly, is my absolute favorite. The big or most important part of that is the medium rare. Duck doesn't carry salmonella the same way that chicken does. So once again, it's about educating people and teaching them that that medium rare is really what you want to see. When I mentioned that there isn't any marbling or fat throughout the breast, that's why that medium rare is so important, because it becomes tough.
Now, one of the other things that I noticed in the recipes, is, as different from turkey, is that a lot of the duck recipes I saw, particularly around Christmas, were spicing the duck up or using citrus to add a different kind of acid, more acidy flavor to the, and sweet flavor to the meat. Is that something that you would suggest folks explore for cooking the duck at Christmas?
100%. I mean, fruit forward, I mean, any dish that has that acid or that sweetness, all it's really doing is breaking up the richness of the duck fat. It pairs really nicely with duck, and especially, I mean, our breed of duck is a white Pekin duck, which is a mild duck. It doesn't have that gamey finish to it. So the fruits really come in through the meat, especially when you stick, whether it's an apple or an orange, inside the cavity. You really do get that hint of fruit that comes through the breast.
So what would be your number one tip for somebody who's never done a duck before for Christmas and says, okay, this year I'm going to do duck? What is the main thing that they should be paying attention to?
Once again, like I mentioned earlier, my number one point for everyone is don't be afraid of medium rare. If you're going to do a breast, what everybody thinks, you know, we've been taught for so long when it comes to poultry that 165 degrees, which is overcooking in our case, that medium rare is the most important part. And again, just treat it like a steak, basically.
Well, thanks very much for your tips. And I imagine you guys are going to be fourth generation family. You guys are going to be having duck for Christmas?
We have duck for Christmas, Easter, and any other holiday you can think of.
Right. And how are you going to be doing it?
We're going to be doing, actually, just like I said, we are going to be doing duck breast. I'm going to use an apple and rosemary rub.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Okay. Have a good Christmas, and thank you very much for your duck advice.
Thank you very much. You too.
That was Chris Konzelman of King Cole Ducks. And from all of us at Harrismith Magazine, Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays. So, here we are at the end of this episode of Harrismith Radio. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please consider subscribing to this podcast on Apple, iTunes, or in your favorite podcast player. And please, tell your friends and family. Got feedback? We'd love to hear it. You can email us at letters@harrismithmag.com. That URL, harrismithmag.com, is also where you can order subscriptions online. And you can find Harrismith Magazine on selected newsstands across Canada. Until next time, for Harrismith Radio, I'm Wayne McPhail. And also, until next time, remember these four words: make, grow, sustain, share. Tune in for the next episode of Harrismith Radio.